Thank you very much. I'm delighted to welcome you all today to discuss the comedy of life, which is effectively to discuss some of the themes from Jelena Krecic's novel, None Like Her. And we're very fortunate to have a married couple to discuss this book because the theme of the book is love and the theme of the book is finding love. And so we have Jelena, the author, who is also historically a journalist and a writer on cultural theory. Slavoj, who is usually introduced as the Elvis of philosophy, but he's told me he now wants to be known as the Trump of philosophy. For reasons which might become apparent.
He doesn't yet know it. When we, the people, take over, he goes to Gulag, you know.
And what are the chances of that happening? So the format of this evening is, I'm going to give a brief introduction to some of the themes of the book. I don't want to give everything away, but we might even have a discussion about whether you should give everything away when discussing a book that most of you won't yet have read. Though I should stress that you haven't read it yet, but it's on sale at the back and there'll be an opportunity to get a signed copy. It's £10, which is a very good price for what is a superb book. I'm going to give this general introduction. Then the translator, Olivia Helliwell, is going to read a very short section from the book. And then we're just going to go into a discussion about some of the themes in the book with all three of us. And then we're going to open up it up to questions from the audience. So please, can you hold your questions until that point? But you will have an opportunity to do that. And there'll be a roving mic, so please do wait for the roving mic when that happens. Okay, so None Like Her. In Plato's Symposium, which is a fantastic book, Aristophanes appears, and he tells this amazing story, a myth, about human beings and love. So human beings originally have four legs and four arms, and a head which had a face on either side. And they used to move around, they'd run around, or they could roll over very quickly. But the trouble was they got above themselves. Oh, I should say that there were different combinations in these human beings, that some were male-male, some were female-female, but most were male-female. They got above themselves. They started rolling up Olympus and started taking on the gods. And as punishment, Zeus had them split. So what was a four-legged animal became a two-legged animal with a face. The genitals were on the wrong side at that point, and they did a bit of switching. So effectively, these animals were split in two, and they felt a great lack. They lost their other half. And that love for Plato, or at least for Aristophanes, can be explained as the search for your other half, your literal other half. There is another half of you that's been cut off from you. And when you find that person, you are in a stunned sense of awe and amazement. You never want to leave that person. You want to spend every moment of the day with them. And you want to be bound back to that person, probably joined physically through the genitals. And if Hephaestus, the blacksmith, the god of the blacksmith of the gods, was around to fuse you together, nobody in their right minds would decline that offer. If you found your other half, you would stick with your other half. And this story of Aristophanes is supposed to embody the romantic ideal of love, that each of us is in pursuit of somebody who actually exists. That's the nature of love. Somebody out there is waiting for you. If only you could find your other half, you would want to be fused forever. Now, that isn't an event in this book, but it is the starting point in a way, because the central character, Matthias, is that the correct pronunciation? I call him Matt. One character calls him Matt. Matt, as the novel begins, has been jilted by his lover, Sarah, whom he thinks is his other half. She is the person he felt destined to love, and he's absolutely distraught. It's set in Ljubljana, and Matt is a young, handsome man, and quite cynical, quite nasty in some ways. He's a photographer. And through a conversation with his friend Alexander, he discovers that the best way to win Sarah back, he thinks, is to lose himself by having another relationship. So he has another relationship with another woman, and the idea is that will somehow make it possible for him to speak to Sarah again, because she won't be afraid that he wants her to get back, and this will loosen things up, and eventually perhaps they'll be able to reunite, or at least have serious conversations and meet for coffee and so on. So this is the starting point for Matt's relentless pursuit of women, and occasionally, by mistake, in at least one case, a man, to somehow get over the loss of his other half. And then the novel plays a kind of musical theme of variation, so that each of the women that he pursues is slightly different, he treats them differently, but the common theme is that he doesn't, he loves her, loves them and leaves them. He's got intimacy issues, you might say. And it, what we have to realise as well is this relationship has broken down with Sarah, or Sarah, partly because the passion of love has gone. You know, that Jonathan Haidt, the psychologist, has written very nicely about this. There's a time when you're in love, when the dopamine's flowing, everything's wonderful, you absolutely can't bear to be apart from the person. And then as things cool off a little bit, as they inevitably do, there's a moment when you transition into what he calls companionate love, where you become, your lives become intertwined in all kinds of ways, but at a less intense level. And that's a very vulnerable point in a relationship. That's the point where you work out whether you are long-term or short-term. Well, that's when his relationship with Sarah had broken down. The relationships with the women that he has tend to be one-night stands, and he sometimes quite brutally leaves his one-night stand the next morning. And so through this sort of variations, he actually discovers himself and actually changes in the novel. And I don't want to say too much about how that happens, but it is a comedy in the sense that it ends with a wedding. There's a sense in which there's progress, there's a sense in which he's a kind of existential figure seeking the meaning of life through his relationships with women. And I strongly recommend the book to you. And I think what we should do now is get a little glimpse of that. I think one of the really interesting features of the book is the way Yellow handles dialogue, which is, for me, a really satisfying aspect of the book, that you're often shown things rather than said, so that the Matt doesn't have a great deal of self-knowledge, but he's a kind of cynical idealist. He's prepared to be brutally honest, and he becomes quite an attractive character, even though he does horrible things. But he's an idealist about love, at least at the beginning. So perhaps we could contextualise this short passage. I mean, Yella, would you like to say something about the passage that Olivia is going to read?
Oh, thank you, Nigel. Let me just say hello to everybody, and thank you for coming today. And thank you, Olivia, for reading this next passage. The passage is taking place today, I mean, on All Saints' Day, which is a huge festival in Slovenia. It's a national holiday. So, like, thousands of people come to cemetery and bring flowers and candles and stuff like that. And Olivia, to whom I am eternally grateful for a great job on translation of the book, is going to read a passage where the main character, Matyáš, meets Brigitta, who is one of also the main characters in the book, and they meet at the cemetery on All Saints' Day. So please, Olivia.
Thank you. He met Brigitta on All Saints' Day. In the evening, he had set out for the graveyard with his camera, looking for interesting subjects. As he lost himself among the numerous graves, the crowd slowly made their way back to the land of the living, and the tranquility of peaceful candles descended over Jale. It was then he caught sight of a girl on a bench under a tree. She was dressed in a long black leather coat, with a hat covering what seemed in the candlelight to be a heap of unruly red hair. She occasionally wound a strand of it around her finger, bringing it up towards her lips as if chewing it nervously. He noticed the cover of the book in which she was engrossed, Marx's Capital. It seemed a bit out of place and heavy going for him, but he decided it was worth a photo. It could make an amusing shot, he thought to himself. He was far enough away for her not to immediately notice his activities. As he focused on her face, he saw that he liked it. It was pale, distinguished by her severe, uneasy expression and stern features, but softened by her lips. And, if he was not mistaken, by her big blue eyes, too, although with the enormous amount of black eyeshadow all over them, he couldn't be quite sure of the colour. Her lower lip was punctured with a piercing, a decoration repeated once more on her eyebrow. A red-haired version of Larson's girl with the dragon tattoo, he thought to himself. Only in this case, the probable tattoos were covered by her clothes. He took some time framing his close-up of this unusual beauty, but his photographic subject kept her gaze, quite an angry gaze, fixed elsewhere. Suddenly, the girl stood up and shouted, "Hey, hey, what are you doing? What are you playing at, you pervert?" Matyaj turned and marched away, but she caught up with him and firmly grabbed hold of his jacket. "Well, what are you doing? Go on, delete it." "No, no, look, the photos are symbolic. They're for the marks. You can't see you at all," he excused himself clumsily. "And who are you taking those for?" "For a newspaper." "Why?" "For Delo." "I got that. I'm asking for your motive." "It's All Saints Day." "And?" "And we're commemorating it in the newspaper." "What a load of crap." After a short pause, she continued, "I don't care anyway. Delete it. I don't want to be dragged through the papers." "But it's not about you. It's about Marx and the dead." "That's much more interesting," Matyaj replied, becoming somewhat more confident. "How funny that my life makes a useful representation of death, but still, no thanks. My Jale is my own, and my Marx in Jale is mine alone too." She was determined. Matyaj realized that she would be a tough nut to crack. He took his camera, pressed a few buttons, and gave it to her. "Look how beautiful you are." The girl glanced at the photos and snorted. "Oh, piss off, will you, with your beautiful. Delete them all." "But I'm convinced this is the best photo from Jale that anyone has taken today, probably ever," Matyaj pleaded helplessly. "Listen, moron, once again, I am not going to be your poster girl for All Saints Day. Get it?" "Why not? Don't you like the dead?" "Fine, let's put it this way. Given that the only people I like are those in a deceased state, I do not want to be in a newspaper for the living. I'm no promoter of the afterlife, but at the same time, I don't see any evidence to suggest that your deceased don't read Della." That made her smile. They agreed to compromise between the living and the dead and chose an image where her face was indistinguishable, but where marks could be seen clearly beside a grave. Such reconciliations must be celebrated. And where better than the Billiard House, a haven for persecuted smokers, the living dead of this world?
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's actually a really interesting passage because Brigitte is abusive to him, calls him a moron and so on. Actually, in most of the relationships, Matt insults the women. He does what pickup artists call negging. I had to look up this up on the web, by the way, which is where you insult your target to make them feel vulnerable and to seek approval from you. And it seems for him to be an incredibly effective way of operating. I was really interested why you wrote from the perspective of quite a misogynist male figure, somebody who is very quick to be extremely rude about physical appearance or mannerisms or whatever of the people he's trying to seduce.
Well, I'm not sure I have a good answer to that. I get this question a lot. I think that it was a challenge for me to try to think as a man and, to be that character. But basically, I think I am attracted to that kind of character. I think Matyaj was inspired by probably 50s movie stars, the strong, silent type, although he is not so silent in the book. So I really created a man that I felt attracted to, I think. So, and his rudeness is part of his charm. I mean,
absolutely, yeah. I mean, he is a very attractive character. I don't know whether that's just because we get the inside view, as it were, of him, or there's something about that willingness to be honest. I mean, rudeness is sometimes just honesty that hasn't been censored. And I think he's quite an honest character.
Yeah, he has a way that he always challenges his friends and his lovers with this direct approach. And I think that is part of the charm, because it builds tension. And I think, as you said, that this approach is very close to, I don't know, the truth, or that it brings something truthful about human relationship.
So that, to me, is very interesting about the book, the way that you are exploring themes of love through a novel. I mean, why didn't you choose to write a book about love? I mean, a straight philosophy book, because you've written about in a philosophical style. Why didn't you write a straight philosophy book?
That's a terrible, very difficult question. Well, I'd say that probably because I am attracted by popular culture, by movies, by genre fiction, and I wanted to experiment with, I don't know, with literary aura in me. So
Savoy, this is a book about love. I'd love to know what you think about love, because my hunch is you're going to think it's a ridiculous bourgeois concept, and we can get beyond erotic love. That's just something that Hollywood sells us.
No, first, okay, you will stop me if I speak for too long.
First, you've only just started.
Yeah. Easy to start with me, difficult to end. First, I don't think even Hollywood is still doing that. I always use this example, two examples, James Bond and the greatest classic of today, Dan Brown. Did you notice something in James Bond films with Quantum of Solace? It's politically very progressive film. In it, basically, James Bond saves Morales' regime in Bolivia against some capitalist corporation takeover. But did you notice that this is the first James Bond movie where, at the end, the love is not consummated? They're just desperate, Daniel Craig and Olga Kurylenko, to name them. They just split apart. Next thing, Dan Brown. I think books should be burned. I think Goebbels had a nice, good principle. In Germany in 1933, he just didn't burn the right books. The right books. Like Dan Brown should be burned. But did you notice how already in the novels, for example, how is that one called? The biggest hit, Da Vinci Code. No sex. I mean, how can you screw the granddaughter of Jesus Christ? No? And it's this kind of perverted transmission. The plot of the story is, of course, the vulgar old crazy conspiracy theory that Jesus Christ really was married. But it's as if, you know, psychoanalysis teaches us this. When you have a great myth out there, forget about what is out there. Look at what happens here in front of our eyes. Poor Jesus Christ has to make love, has to F, to cover up the fact that there is no sex here. Between Langdom and so on.
Okay, so you've avoided the question.
Sorry, No. Let's go on then. An even stranger thing. The second, earlier novel, but the second Dan Brown movie, Angels and Demons. Very strange thing happens. In the novel, there is sex at the end. Between the Langdom and that Vittoria Vetra, whatever, an Italian scientist lady. In the movie, they have thrown out sex. Where are the old days where we were saying Hollywood adds sex to make it more commercial? Now Hollywood is throwing it out. And I think this is a very sad tendency. It's in our new type of hedonism. Even if we do real sex, we more and more do it in a masturbatory way. There is a wonderful scene in, did you see, for me, absolutely one of the candidates for the greatest British movie of all times, Terry Gilliam's Brazil. Remember that wonderful scene in a restaurant where you order a meal and then you get literally, in Lacanian sense, a kind of a divided meal. What you physically get is a kind of a piece of dog shit, just anonymous, like some kind of porridge stuff. And then you get above it a beautiful photo of what this really is. That's our sex more. You just need woman or the body as that piece of feet so that you can fantasize about the image. So okay, back so to what I'm saying, I don't think that today's ideology, I don't mean official ideology, but simply how we perceive ourselves, our desires, how society suggests us to do it, is still passionate sexual love. It's something much closer to deconstructionist Judith Butler theory. Don't get overtly attached, experiment with yourself, reconstruct yourself, discover new freedoms, and so on. So I think we live in very sad times. And then I will stop just to tell you the last proof. I spoke with some American friends who are practicing psychoanalysts, which I will never be. Why? Because as an analyst, you have calmly to listen to another person. Can you imagine me doing that? But okay. And they told me that half a century ago, if a man, married man or woman, was jumping around from one woman to another, this was considered something pathological, you know. Clinical feature, oh, we have to analyze it, what is this guy trying to avoid escaping from? Today, it's the opposite. If you jump around, it's normal. If you are faithful to your partner, oh, pathology, fixation, and so on. I really think that that's, for me, the problem with standard critique of patriarchy and so on. That's no longer the ruling ideology. The ruling ideology.
I asked you about love, and you talked to me about sex, which is interesting. I mean, they're connected.
Okay, no. Okay, I will answer to you that one. Well. Love, I'm very metaphysical here. Sex without love is masturbatory. Even if it's really another person, you really use the other as plastic dildo or whatever, as a physical prop just to get enjoyment. The only way to reach out to the other beyond your fantasy is love. And I'm quite metaphysical here, but not in Plato's sense. Yes, I think that, first, I agree with, I think it was Neil Gaiman, I quote it in my violence book, who wrote a wonderful passage on it's difficult to imagine anything more brutal, violent than passionate love. Look, let's say you are a modern deconstructionist Judith Butler person. You reconstruct yourself, you run around, you have one night stands, drinks, then you fall in love. It's a catastrophe. All your daily love is thrown off the rails. You're obsessed by it. That's why love is something that doesn't fit our universe. And that's why I love. I think love is precisely, and that's why Christianity has such a problem with carnal love, not because it's the opposite, but because it's its greatest competitor. If by metaphysics we mean this, we are in our daily life, ordinary concerns, and then some higher cause obsesses us, our ordinary life is ruined. Love is this. Love is the basic metaphysical experience. Second thing, and with this I will finish, love is always contingent. Love is the beautiful example of contingency turned around into necessity. What is love? You walk on the street, sorry for the stupid example, you sleep on a banana, a lady who is totally by chance there helps you to stand up, and you discover this is the love of your life. And automatically, you restructure all your past life as if I was alive just to arrive at this moment, you know?
Okay, so yellow.
You brutally deprived me of my
work. I didn't help him get up after he slept on the
last banana. Time I interviewed you, you called me your super ego. I wonder what you're going to call me this time. But, Yella, within the novel, do you think that Matt fits that example that Slaboy had there of using women in a kind of masturbatory way, that in a sense they become objects to fulfil his desires? Or is there something else going on? Because there's this succession of women that he doesn't stay with for long. He doesn't really seem that into seducing them. He sort of almost does it as a tick. Is he a Don Juan figure? What is he doing?
I think that he begins as a Don Juan who doesn't really believe in true love anymore. But gradually he changes, he develops a little bit, and at the end, I think he becomes a believer of a true love. So he starts as a very desperate person, just trying to find his way in life with women, and then gradually he becomes more inclined to love.
Because it seems to me that in the negging that I talked about, you know, when he's flirting through insulting the women, he's got more respect for them in a sense because he's being honest with them than he is when he's in the bedroom because he's, you know, he's using them at that point. Before, there's a mutual game going on where there's a to and fro, and they come back at him sometimes, and sometimes they overreact, sometimes they can stand up to him. But in the bedroom, he seems to be using them physically purely to satisfy his lust.
Yes, but...
There's no glimmer of love.
No, no. At least at the beginning, there's no glimmer of love. But it's true that there's a lot of failure even in the bedroom, in a sense that he does not succeed in his endeavors.
So that's the theme of variations. It's not like one seduction after another, 100% success rate. But he does have a high hit rate, for sure.
I just wanted to add that... I chose this structure because comedy thrives on failures, and it was funny to me that you know every other woman is a total failure for Matyáš, and that he needs to go through all these women and these failures in order to, as Beckett would say, fail better with his love at the end.
So it's a romantic story.
A very short remark, very important. I can confirm this in my relationship with her, how love works in a strange way. When I was seducing her, I went into all this bullshit, you know. It's not just physical love, something deeper, blah, blah. And basically, I'm sorry to tell you this, she told me, listen, do you know that sometimes I don't want all the deeper crap. I just want to be fully objectified and used and so on. And this is part of true love. Whenever your lover is telling you, you know, it's not just physical love, it's much more, your bells should ring, run away as fast as you can.
So did you use the Trump method?
Sorry?
Did you use the Trump method?
No.
Use the Trump method? It's quite a brutal confession in a sense. Did you go the Trump method?
Trump is a great democratic politician, our only hope, and so on. Wait a minute, I'm not kidding. Remember what Trump did. Are you aware? I'm not kidding. He single-handedly destroyed practically the Republican Party. It's falling apart. Not too bad an achievement. But seriously, you know what's the problem? And there is another topic we debated with you. you know why Trump is really vulgar? Not so much as when he is vulgar with this touching, but he's the most tragically vulgar precisely when he doesn't want to weep but does it in a wrong way. For example, once I was shocked. At some press conference, he celebrated Melania. Melania, she's Slovene, you know. We Slovenes will, in a week, maybe occupy the White House and so on. But okay. And to celebrate her gentleness, refinement, I'm afraid to use that word. I will use a more subtle, refined word. He said, you know, in all my years with her, I haven't heard her not even once flatulence emitting that sound, you know. But, okay, maybe we sometimes do this. That what is truly vulgar for me is even to mention this in public, you know. Like, you know, the true vulgarity is not so much to do things, but it's to publicly mention things you don't talk about. Like, he did the same with Hillary. You remember Hillary disappeared in the middle of some debate for a minute, and Trump said, obviously, she had to run to the restroom toilet, and Trump said, oh, can you imagine, where did she go? Disgusting. No, we all do this. It's not disgusting. Just don't talk about it. Disgusting is to say this publicly. So, in spite of all my political admiration for Trump, no, he is not like me. He is not my friend.
So, I was interested that you described your relationship, the early stages of it, as you seducing Yella, which is the model in the book, actually. You know, it doesn't seem to be very reciprocal.
This is not how it functions. Yeah. I'm here a total pessimist. We men think this, but from the beginning we are invisibly manipulated. We don't know even how. Like, I think women talk with each other, they decide which woman will get whom, and it's all, we are dead before even we know.
Well, it's interesting, in the novel, the character who's strongest, it seems to me, is the one who becomes the most attractive, the one who is capable of withholding, of playing hard to get, of actually choosing the moment and the limits of what she's prepared to do. She's the one who actually becomes the one who can really compel Matt's attention.
But he is feminine fantasy. I will tell you something, it will not embarrass you. It was widely assumed that the model for Matyáš is a Slovene very good photographer, and he was Jela's previous boyfriend. I can tell you, we are now friends, that he is a very nice guy, not like that. It was Jela's dream that he should have been such, more brutal and so on.
Well, I told you so. The silent type from the 50s, Humphrey Bogart sort of person.
Or is this to avoid libel?
Sorry?
You're not just avoiding libel. So that's interesting. So the photography thing, so there was an autobiographical element.
Yes, there are. But I think that the truth of fiction is that it is a creation of a new world. Even if you pick some things from reality, the way you mold the story is actually a totally new life. And I really molded all the characters and really wanted to push through this line of thought, you know. And maybe I was thinking when you were talking about Plato and the two halves looking for each other, I think that comedy is not very Platonistic in that sense. I think that the standpoint of comedy is that that no half is ever gonna fit another half, so that there is a certain impossibility to love. But although that love is impossible, you can make it work. So I think that's the miracle that comedy provides.
Well, I thought your novel was more existential in the sense that there are no givens. There's no romantic model that you have to follow. There's a sense in which you create a model through your choices, and you choose in the light of the things that happen to you, not in the light of any kind of given framework within which love has to function. So that there's a kind of self-discovery. It's like a Bildung's Roman. There's a sense in which the character discovers things through his interaction. But his actually in the Symposium, the Socratic position is very different from Aristophanes' position, which is that you learn from your love, and it was homoerotic love, that the man falls in love with a beautiful young man. Socrates falls in love with a beautiful young man. Love isn't just about infatuation with that one individual, because if you love a beautiful person, you love them because they're beautiful. You start admiring beauty in other people. You admire the abstract concept of beauty. And gradually you move up what's called Diotima's ladder, this ladder up to the point where you're focusing on the ideal form of things, not on the actual individual, which is almost the opposite of what we think of as love, which is love is about the individual. You're then focused on the idea of beauty or of love or perfection. So that for Plato, the whole process is one of getting away from reality. Whereas in the novel, there's a sort of sense in which Matt's development is towards being aware of what's around him and getting away from being in the grip of a particularly pernicious Platonic view about what love should be.
Yeah, I would agree with that, yes.
Can I add something? You can stop me. But I agree with you, but in this sense, I think the big opposition, and Kierkegaard himself knew it very well in his philosophical fragments, or how it's usually translated, wonderful, it's precisely Socrates versus Jesus Christ. I'm a Christian here, although an atheist. I think that precisely, as you said, the Christian view is that, okay, you go up to all these ideas, but then you have to fall down radically to a single individual. That's the paradox of Christianity. God, universal, and so on, but at the end, we are back to one person, a stupid, ordinary guy in Palestine, and so on. That's the first thing. The second thing, things get here complicated in love precisely in the same way as in theology. Look, if I say to some person, I love you because you have beautiful hair, legs, even brain, it's not true love. True love goes the other way around. I discover how beautiful you are because I love you. Love is not objective. If love were to be objective, it's a matter of mental accountancy. I have you and her. I put a list. You have nice whatever, hair, legs. The other lady has eyes, and I put, oh, wait, you are 2 points higher, it's you. Higher, it's you. That's not love. Love is precisely like intelligent theologists say, how it's obscene to say, I become a Christian because I found the arguments of Jesus Christ quite convincing. No, if you were in medieval times, you should be burned for saying that. It's the opposite. True Christian attitude is, because you believe, you can understand Christianity. And that's the structure of love. So I am here, in this sense, again, Christian. Love is contingent also in this radical sense that you are in love for reasons. But these reasons appear to you as such only once you already are in love. Second point, which is important for me, made very nicely by Lacan. Love is sublimation, not idealization. This means in true love, you don't idealize your partner. That's the miracle of love. You noticed all the dirty details, whatever, imperfections, but they make you love the beloved even more. That's the miracle of love, how you have here an imperfect human being, here, not me, but you know, in all this imperfection, she is the absolute, or he, or whatever, now in this transgender anti-species time, or it, or a dog, or whatever, whomever you love.
Well, in a way, the women that, most of the women that Matt meets are interchangeable. They are interchangeable, so they fail as lovers, truly lovers in that sense, because they are just simply a means to an end for him. He's not interested in them as individuals.
But do we betray too much? You censor, you warned me in advance, I shouldn't say too much. That the big surprise is who becomes
the one.
That is a big surprise. Let's leave it as a surprise for
I will just polemicize with you. You know, we started before in the back room there, green room, how is it called? Yeah, it reminds me of, you know, all those red green rooms in Twin Peaks. You know, I don't think that it really spoils the game if you... We say too much if you know the ending. And even in detective novels, I will give you a perfect proof. They are no longer watchable today, but years ago I liked them. Columbo. What was the revolution of Columbo? The crime is perfectly shown at the beginning. You know everything. So what we are waiting for is not to discover what really happened, but how Columbo will establish the link between what really happened and ordinary reality. How will he establish a link? And another thing why Columbo was very intelligent, I mean, as a series, is, did you notice something very mysterious which brings us back to this structure of love? The mystery of Columbo is this one. A murder or whatever happens, Columbo arrives at the crime scene and immediately he knows who is the culprit. And then it's just slowly how he will prove it.
Now, this is interesting because that's also following the model of how you describe love, that you fall in love with somebody, then you discover the reasons. It's also the model that Nietzsche has for philosophy, that philosophers express a conclusion which is miraculously consistent with their deepest heartfelt beliefs. Mm-hmm. And then they tell you it's actually the product of rational, logical processes. So Kant happens to end up in his moral philosophy with a kind of Protestant Christian position about how you should be honest and not tell lies and so on. And he makes out that it's just because he reasoned from ordinary experience to this position, but actually, as Nietzsche points out, it's just
Let's forget about all this bullshit philosophical reasoning. I think the best definition of philosophy was provided by ancient Greeks apropos Socrates. The duty of a philosopher is to corrupt the youth. No, I don't mean it in an immoral sense, but like to tear them out, to destabilize them, to make them doubt the ruling ideology,
just
whatever.
Just for those people who don't know, that was one of the charges that led to Socrates' execution.
That's what I meant, In a way, from the standpoint of existing power, The Athenian court, democratic court, don't forget this, was totally right. They were classical.
See, I would say you're just, that's another example of what I was talking about with Nietzsche. That's what you like doing, and then you give reasons about why that should be the whole of philosophy.
But he wasn't doing it enough, because, you know, you corrupt the youth, and then you end up appropriated by Hitler, you know. Although Nietzsche was a much nicer person. For example, he was always proud about his Polish ancestry. Not exactly a Nazi feature. Another thing, in a wonderful part, I think you may correct me if I'm wrong, in Genealogy of Morals, such a beautiful idea. He provides the ultimate anti-Semitic grim. He says, we Germans are aggressive, warlike, Jews are merchants. If we bring Germans and Jews together, we would be absolutely unbeatable. No, that's his dream. Ah, that's the Nietzsche that I like.
Well, you are famous for saying that Gandhi was more violent than Hitler, aren't you?
But I meant it in a positive sense. No, sorry. For me, what I mean there by violence is, of course, not physical violence, but how much did you really change reality? And I was just making, in a provocative way, I admit it, the old Marxist point that, again, to use Nietzsche's terms, Hitler's violence was deeply reactive. He was ready to kill millions, so just that ultimately the existing economic order remains the same. He was active not to change things. And this is a wonderful example from everyday obsessional neurosis. Believe me, I can bear witness to it because I am one, obsessional neurotic. You know, people ask me, why am I so hyperactive? Not to change things, but so that to make it sure that nothing will change. Like, you can imagine how my own psychoanalysis looked. I talked all the time. Why? Because I was afraid that if I stop talking for a second, the analyst may ask me some truly embarrassing question. So I was active all the time to make it sure that nothing changes. And there was something of this in Hitler. It was, while Gandhi, whatever you say, and I'm very critical of Gandhi, with all his non-violence and so on, sorry, he did change things, India became independent, and so on. Only in this sense, I mean it.
Okay, I think this would be a good time to open up for questions, actually. If we've got a roving mic somewhere, I believe. Is that true? There was advertised a roving mic at the back. So I can barely see because I'm blinded by lights here.
Did you do your Stalinist duty? Did you organise the debate? Did you distribute questions?
Yeah, I distributed questions, so you should get some tough questions now. There's one over here I can see. Maybe if you can... Is there just one mic? Yeah, so wait for the mic. Please do wait for the mic. Can you wave if you've got another question, anybody? I can't really see. Yep, I've got one at the back there up next.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to know if, because for what I hear, I haven't read the novel, and it sounds like there is associated with very classical stereotypical roles, like the male, the female, the seduction idea we have. And is there any place for, or you have thought about non-binary relationships, or is there any thought about that in this novel, or maybe some influence or anything about that?
Sorry, I didn't hear the question completely there.
I understood it, that it's only male, female, and so on. Is there a place, please, lady, correct me if I'm wrong, for other not standard roles, like not just heterosexual, male, female, for other...
Yeah, good.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean, yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
I mean, one of my aims in the novel was to provide very different characters, very different female characters. And as Nigel said, the main character winds up with a transvestite one night, and there is a lesbian figure. So I tried to include different positions.
And I will do now something for which, but I believe in Columbo model, for which you both will lynch me.
Don't do it.
You know, feminists.
Don't do it.
What? You're rejoining women. Where is male bonding, my God? No, because, okay, I'll put it in this way, very abstractly, sorry.
Precisely
what you worried about, non-conventional, plays a major positive role at the end. That's all that I will say.
But the incident of the transvestite is very interesting because there's a lack of awareness on Matt's part about how intimate he is. This is shown rather than said, but there's a kind of intimacy that only genitals prevent going further. I mean, because in a sense, that relationship could very well be a fundamental one for him because he's so much in tune with that individual and so attracted to that individual. And there's a kind of criticism built into the description, I felt. There's a kind of sense in which he doesn't realise what he's doing as he's doing it and the degree to which he could easily have formed a relationship with that person, but convention and his prejudices didn't lead him down that route.
Yeah, that's true. That's a correct description. But I wanted to stress out that, to me, it was important to show that impossibility which I was talking about. And I used these different characters to have this input of different impossibilities or different challenges that one has when trying to find true love. So it was a conceptual, it was, how do you say, it was a deliberate decision to go to have all these differences and so on.
That's what I meant in a sense, is a theme of variations. It's very musical with a kind of resolution, but it's a kind of false cadence and then there's a different resolution. It's really interesting the way it ends. But there's a question. Have you got the microphone there? Yeah. Can we pass the microphone down to a question at the back? Oh, gosh, there are people in the upper tier as well. Is anybody... I don't know how we can get a microphone up there if you've got a question up there. But... Thank you.
Earlier you spoke about psychoanalysis, and I was interested to know whether you think psychoanalysis can be scientific or not.
Can be.
Scientific
or not. Can psychoanalysis be scientific or not? Do you think psychoanalysis is scientific?
Well, as Lacan answered this question... And I don't want, please, to... I feel bad for talking too much, so I will try to be short. You know, the question... Lacan changed this question into a question, how radically do we have to change the notion of science so that psychoanalysis fits into it? Because obviously, at a certain direct level, if we take as a model, as a paradigm, what today counts as serious science and so on... Obviously, psychoanalysis is not a science. Why? Because science, the subject of science, by definition, as Lacan puts it, forecloses or rather excludes subjectivity. The whole point of science is that the one who speaks as a scientist should be, it doesn't matter who it is, empty, anonymous, and so on. And for Lacan, precisely in psychoanalysis, the whole point is that it matters who speaks. And not only this, but even, how should I put it, when you say something, this is the biggest epistemological break, in psychoanalysis, when you say something which is obviously wrong in the objective sense, when you make a mistake, slip of tongue, whatever, that's where truth explodes. Like, you make a slip of tongue, a mistake, it's a lie. But a lie can tell more about you than the truth. Which is why in analysis I was in, I know it. I tried to lie all the time. I invented dreams and so on, and my analyst just laughed at me and told me that not only was it obvious that I'm lying, but through my lies I betrayed myself much more than I would have by telling the truth. So I'm just saying that I still think psychoanalysis is something extremely serious today, more actual than ever, because Freud's problem was never this Viennese Victorian oppression. Freud's problem is not you are impotent because you have a severe father who terrorizes you. No. Freud's fundamental problem is if you have a tolerant father who tells you, did you do it with any girls, and so on and so on. It's an even better way to make you, if you are a boy, impotent, and so on. So I think that's why psychoanalysis is actual more than ever today in our permissive times. I stop.
Okay. The question down here, I don't know if you can see.
Yeah, I wanted to ask both of you a question about marriage, and you also, I think you mentioned that the book ends in marriage, right? So,
there is a marriage,
not the hero's marriage.
Okay. Well. Anyway.
I'm sorry. Okay. Now
he might
go.
Be lying, of course.
We will be.
I will still read it. Anyway.
Lies a lot, so.
No, the question is, because many people today dismiss marriage as like, well, it's just a piece of paper, we can live together without getting married. Do you think there is a role for marriage nowadays which goes beyond the merely, let's say, bureaucratic reasons?
Maybe Jelle could answer this one. Yeah.
Yes, I have a great answer, but it's not mine, actually. It's from Mladen Dolar's Slavoj's friend.
From who?
Mladen Dolar. You probably know him as a philosopher. Anyhow, Mladen Dolar said that the function of marriage is that it sort of liberates you from the constant tension of proving your love to the loved one. So you get married in order to relax in a relationship. So I like that answer. But Slavoj is more fundamental here, right?
For marriage, yes. No, this theory of marriage is what I call the Tibetan praying meal or wheel, you know. Know what Tibetans do. It's a little bit racist dream. I don't know what to do. But the idea is you put a prayer, write it on a piece of paper, you put it into a wheel, you turn it around, and then you can think about sex, whatever you want, but objectively you are praying, you know. So it's, and even in Hegel, you found implicitly a wonderful theory of marriage, which is you are passionately in love with a girl or man, whatever. You cannot get a calm moment for it, what to do, nervous. Marry him or her. Soon you will get overused to it, you will grow indifferent. If you want to kill the excess of love, you get married. But I don't quite buy this. I think that precisely today, when marriage less and less plays the role, this economic role of breeding children, whatever, transferring property, that marriage is more actual. For me, marriage is a kind of a symbolic act of telling publicly society, fuck off, I have someone for whom I care more, you are out. It's a wonderful public declaration of indifference.
It's interesting, John Stuart Mill wrote very passionately about marriage as companionship, as friendship, and sort of the sense in which it doesn't have to be at a high, passionate level to be something that's
valuable. Yeah, but it doesn't hurt to have a little bit of passion.
Well, sure. But it may be, I mean, this is, I mentioned Jonathan Haidt, the happiness hypothesis. He talks a lot about this, and it's very interesting. You know, psychologically, you can't hope for that passion to be at a high level throughout a long relationship. It's not plausible, and this is part of the modern version of the Platonic myth, that you find your other half and the passion will be intense for 50 years, and it just won't. It's going to grow into something else with the entwinement of lives.
But, sorry, the last time I speak, but I hope you agree with me, but for me, the true test of a relationship, okay, it's nice, those passionate nights, blah, 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 but as my good friend Alain Badiou, the French guy, developed, the other side of love is to expand it into everyday life, to establish all these small rituals, how you structure your life. You know, it's not just passionate nights. It's, my God, daily life. Who cooks breakfast? How do you go here, there? And this is sometimes, I'm not exaggerating, not as important as sex, but quite a beautiful part, maybe the most beautiful part of a relationship. This patient, I would call it in a Christian way, the work of love. Patiently structuring your daily life as a couple, as the two sharing the same space.
And if I may add something, I think the trick is how the little tortures of life, I don't know, you are tired or overworked or whatever, how you get through them as a couple, but in a sense that this love is comical, that actually the impossibilities, impasses become a motor of, I don't know, wittiness and humor and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So that's what I believe in, a comical love, I would call it.
Better than tragic love.
Absolutely. Tragic love is overrated.
Another question, second row there.
Yes, thank you. I haven't read the book yet, and it sounds very interesting and relatable and important on a lot of sort of broad levels. I'm wondering about the kind of specific context in which it takes place, and do you think there's anything kind of Slovene about the novel, and if so, what would that mean, or what does that look like?
Well, thank you for that question. I think the answer is twofold. On one sense, the book was definitely inspired by Hollywood classic comedies, by even by British TV sitcoms. So, in short, by the best pieces of comedy we have. But on the other hand, the book is very integrated into Ljubljana, the capital of Slovenia, and the characters are breathing that air, and you can sort of feel the structure of this city. But I think that actually Ljubljana is a very average European city, so it's not as exotic as one might expect.
But I think that where the book succeeds, I'm sorry, I will tell you, my friend, although I have political suspicions about him, but he's really a nice guy, Hanif Kureishi, he provided the best answer to this dilemma. Once he told me I'm writing a new novel, and I couldn't restrain, for me, the definition of a friend is someone who you can insult to the end in all ways, and he accepts it. So I said, oh, he said, it will be totally different book from the others. And I told him, oh, but nonetheless, you know, like in all your books, the hero will have a Pakistani diplomat father who is a failed writer and so on. Like, how, no? And he gave me a perfect answer. He said, but don't we all have fathers who are Pakistani diplomats, who are failed writers? You know, like the true art elevates a particular situation, very specific, into something absolutely universal that you can relate to. And that's the wager of the book. We cannot say if it will work or not, but the hope is that this shitty, I despise her company, this Ljubljana cafeterias where people meet, that it will find this universal echo, but we cannot decide it in advance.
Just before this other question, did you comment on the book as it was being written?
At the end, yeah.
And was it changed as a result?
Not yeah, a lot.
He made some great insights. Slavoj is very, he has great imagination and feeling for characters, so.
Really?
Yeah.
I wouldn't. I don't like to be seen like that. I like to see myself as a brutal guy who is friendly towards everyone. But you know, this, you British are the best in it. This fake friendliness, very polite, but keep at a distance.
Can I just say,
is reason for divorce, what
thank
you
very
say
much
now.
For that.
Hi, thank you very much for your talk. So I haven't read the book. But I was wondering, we are discussing a lot about love, love affairs, but the title of the book is The Comedy of Life. So what is the relation?
No, the title is None Like Her.
The title of the event is The Comedy of Life.
Oh, okay.
The title of the book is None Like
Her.
The
title of the event is The Comedy of Life. So why have you chosen this title for the event if we are discussing about love? So what is the relation between love and life?
Love and?
Comedy.
Comedy, yeah.
Oh,
love and life more than comedy, because you have already discussed
comedy of life. Oh, that's interesting. Why is it the comedy of life, not the comedy of love?
Well, I think because this event was not scripted beforehand, so the conversation just went as it went, and we ended up in
the
love.
But why is the title the comedy of life?
Well, ask the organizers, that's all I can say. I don't think... No, I'm not protesting it, but can I make, again, the last time, a short remark, very short. You know, when you say comedy, just be very precise. Comedy for me does not mean, ooh, ooh, it's easy stuff, we laugh. Can I draw your attention to 2-3 interesting details? Did you notice how all the best movies on Holocaust are comedies? Not because it's not serious, but because when things are really horrifying, there is something false to present them as tragic, because, you know, in a tragedy, you still have the tragic hero's dignity. And life in Holocaust, in Auschwitz, or in Gulag, was, you were so broken down that You were beyond the tragic dignity. That's why if you read the ultimate book, Primo Levi, If This Is a Man, it's full of genuinely comical details. So things are much more, just be careful, ambiguous here. Comedy is light, but comedy can also be something you can, the only way to cope with the situation which is so horrible that it's beyond tragedy. If you permit me, I'm sorry.
But that's not the book isn't about the tragedy or the comedy in that terrible sense, is it? The comedy of life, do you say a certain kind of
Yeah, but there is silent despair beneath it. That's what I think.
The conclusion
that
is
isn't it that most of the heroes are in a silent, refined way, not in this, I want to kill myself, but in a subtle way, I claim.
They don't seem unhappy, do they?
Sorry?
The characters aren't unhappy for the most part. They may be trapped in a world.
I would say despair even. Maybe it's too strong a word. But
there is a bit of despair.
And there's progress as well. So it's not like nothing happens and everything stays in a terrible situation. There is progress.
Mm.
And relationships. What strikes me is Matt is a very cynical outsider figure, but he's got very strong friendships, reliable friendships. Apart from the way that he's trying to seduce, he has, throughout the book, several characters who are strong friends with him.
He has his own gang, yeah.
So it doesn't seem to be pessimistic about human relationships to me. It seems actually quite optimistic in the sense this guy can lose his lover, can find lots of sex, can actually find different sorts of relationships and friendships that work for him. So I didn't find that.
Yeah, but maybe I misread it, but I think these friends are not friends who really understand him, but maybe...
Because he doesn't get insulted.
No, it's more like, how should I put it, they are friends who can be helpful precisely by way that they superficially misread him. Friends can also do this when you are in truly desperate situation. The last thing you want is somebody who would really understand you. You need... And you know, like he is like this guy, Alexander, or who?
Yeah, but he is a true friend. I mean, that's a real friendship.
We will, in the evening alone, we will.
that's a
I will
question,
give you a chance to correct your errors.
Yeah.
No, but I wanted to say just to add something to what you were saying about horrible traumas of society and comedy. It's very interesting that the best movies on the Second World War were comedies. The Great Dictator and To Be or Not to Be from Ernst Lubitsch. And they are great movies and they really tackle the theme in the right way, I think. It's not pathetic, it's not desperate. Yeah. It's interesting that comedy can address such terrible times in the best way, I'm sure.
So does that mean that you are pessimistic about relationships? And if you are you agreeing with Slavoj's account of the despair of these characters?
I think that finding true love is probably the biggest trauma of average individual. So that's why I think comedy is great with love, because love is so troublesome and having a relationship is very hard and so on.
I mean, Sartre famously said that human relationships collapse into either sadism or masochism, that you either assert yourself so much that the other person becomes an object to you, or you become an object to them. That didn't seem to be the way you were heading.
No, and I don't want to sound despair. I just think that structurally, you know, life is a very complex thing, and sometimes it's very hard. And
well, that's why I started with Plato, the idea of perfection. Well, let's get rid of that. You have imperfection, but you can still celebrate imperfection without cancelling despair.
But may I add something? Wouldn't you agree that Sartre, although I have otherwise great respect for him, blah, blah, is simply wrong here? I don't think that sadism means objectifying your victim. Lacan's thesis, beautiful one, is that it's on the contrary, not objectifying, but look, the point of a sadist is not just to torture the victim, But to torture the victim in such a way, publicly disclosing him, her, that the victim is aware of the shamefulness and utterly ashamed and so on and so on, sadism is not objectifying. If there is an object in sadist relationship, it's the torturer himself. That's why I think, for example, Stalinism was sadist or perverse. Not because they were doing also, because they were doing those horrible things, but because the strict definition of a Stalinist communist is pure instrument of historical necessity. I know better, sorry if you are my victim, I know better than you people what you want, and on this behalf, even if it's against your will, I can torture you or whatever and so on and so on. Things are much more complex in psychoanalysis, you know. Things about masochism, sadism and so on and so on.
Well, Sartre might have been psychologically naive there, but I think his point was about objectification. Not, he chose the word sadism presumably to be dramatic. I don't think it was sadism in that sense.
Yeah, but don't you think that when somebody is objectified, it works only because he or she remains a subject and finds this extremely humiliating and so on and so on. You want to humiliate the other by treating him or her as an object. Precisely, you can only humiliate a subject, not an object.
Well, let's face it, if he did mean that, it still didn't make it a particularly attractive situation. any more questions? Okay. Yes, there's one at the front row, and then one at the back, in the back row after that.
This is for both of you. What do you think is the role of money in love, and is this approached in the book?
No. The role of money?
Okay, there is no money in the book.
they buy quite a few drinks, I have to say.
Yeah, but that's all they buy. I mean, no property buying. But otherwise, I don't think I have a stance on love and money. Slavoj, I'm counting on you.
Not about love and money, but about sex and money. I always had a deep respect. I saw some documentaries on prostitutes who claimed, okay, I'm against prostitution, I mean, but generally. But some of them said, I want simple sex, and I'm terribly afraid of all that emotional burden and so on and so on. And if money is involved, there is something so liberating in it, you know, like you get the pure, rough stuff without all the emotional luggage and so on and so on. And why am I mentioning this? Because it's exactly for the same reason that in psychoanalysis there has to be money. You pay the analyst. As Lacan and Freud put it very nicely, without money, the analyst would become too involved into the pathological circle and so on. Money means I'm doing it for money, keep me out.
So it's like marriage.
Well, I wouldn't go. No. With marriage, sorry, don't be mad. I have another theory. Marriage is much worse than prostitution because in prostitution, when you need sex, you pay for it. In marriage, you have to pay for it to be with the wife, but then if you don't make love, to keep the wife satisfied, you again have to give her money so that she doesn't annoy you. I mean, marriage is hell from this.
That's a very sexist view of marriage, isn't it?
We talk here like communists, openly.
I'd like to switch completely subject. You said, Yela, that you are grateful to Olivia for the translation. Could you explain a bit how the process went and if there are any particular challenges?
Well, let me just say that I find it a miracle that a person who is totally English found interest in a minority language such as Slovene. And it's even a greater miracle that she found my book interesting and that she really struggled with it, did the hard work, and I think she did really a great job. How the process went, it's probably a question for Olivia herself. Let me just say that we did some communicating. When she had some troubles or didn't understand certain words, she would email me and I would give my suggestions. But in general, it was all her. I mean, she didn't give me a lot of work with the English translation. So again, thank you for this question, because I cannot stress out enough how happy I am that Olivia exists.
And it means...
And I want to add something. You will be mad at me, but I read the novel in the manuscript, and when you showed me some pages of translation, I think I even told you this. I said, my God, but this is better than the original, you know. It's a little bit like you, Olivia, you are, how is it called, the big translator, Norman Kemp Smith, of Kant, and everybody knows that linguistically. The English translation is better than the original, because Kant is a confused writer. He has this one page, one sentence with all that. And Norman Kemp Smith does a wonderful job. He breaks it down into 3-4 sentences, but all the logic is there.
Allegedly, some Germans actually read Kant in English because of that.
Yeah, which is
crazy.
Yeah.
There was a question over there at the back. There are two, actually, so they're close together for a change.
I think this guy...
Oh, sorry. Yeah, because it's very hard for me to see here.
Thanks. Hi, I was wondering whether there was a space in the book to look at maybe this new modern sort of Silicon Valley marketplace approach to love. You know, how, you know, through Tinder and other apps, there's more like love is kind of a market. And is there a space for it in the book?
Oh, well, I tried to make book as contemporary as possible, but it was written quite a few years ago, before I think Tinder even existed. But there are some references to Facebook and all these new gadgets young people use. Although I have to say that, because I don't use and I don't operate on Facebook and stuff like that, I wasn't, I was afraid it would not be very convincing if my characters were too engaged in that stuff. But I tried to grasp youth between, let's say, 25 and 35. And this was written a few years ago, so you do the math.
But don't get it wrongly. We are not such a primitive country. I mean, everybody uses Facebook and Twitter in Slovenia. Just we don't. I'm here a Stalinist. I think Facebook and Twitter, this is just a loss of time. I would have in my ideal state secret police checking on people. If you are on Facebook more than 1 hour per day, you are mobilized to clean toilets in hospitals and so on and so on. Sorry. Why are you so skeptical? Are you using on
Twitter? No, Facebook, Twitter. You can find me on Twitter most hours.
Yeah. So you don't have more complex thoughts? Everything you want to say can be put in, what, 130
characters? That's so naive about how Twitter works. That's so naive about how Twitter works. You can always link to other things. Yeah. But actually, concision can be quite effective.
Unfortunately, that's true. Yeah.
Hi. So... I'm very intrigued by this book, Yela. I want to read it. It would have been lovely to have read it before coming here. So I'm just trying to use the little glimpses of information that we're getting to kind of to get some insight into it. And one book it reminds me of is Filth by Irvin Welsh. Just that aspect, I don't know if you know it, I think it's quite recent, just that aspect of a strong, silent type who goes around exploiting women in this flurry of activity, almost, you know, from one person to the other. That book, I don't think, is about love, is about that character and obviously how complex he is. So that inevitably makes me wonder about your book and your character and why he's in this flurry of activity of jumping from one person to the other, which links in nicely with what Slavoj pointed out, that this flurry of activity can be just a means of trying to fight change, trying to fight keep things as they are. So is there something revealing about the character in the way he goes about this flurry of activity, and how's that resolved? Surely there is change, he can't fight it at the end.
Sorry, I'm not sure if I, because we don't hear as...
There's a bit of an echo here, actually.
Sorry.
So, did I understand correctly? You're asking me if my book was inspired by some other book from...
No, I'm just trying to draw parallels, because obviously I haven't read yours, but what I took from the other one was that this strong but silent type who is very active in going through different people in what superficially looks like perhaps searching for love, that might be conveying more about them and their struggle with themselves than about love, you know, finding love. So I wonder if there is any of that theme in your book as well, whether your character, you know, why is he so active? Is he, yeah, like Slavoj pointed out, is he fighting something? Is he fighting change? Is he fighting himself?
Yes, at least at the beginning, you can feel that all this, even all the humor comes out of this silent despair, because he's actually pretty broken up after his ended relationship. And I have to say that you will probably find many references in the book, in a sense. You will see that it was inspired by Hollywood comedies, and probably some of them even have similar premise of the story.
Make it clear, sorry. By Hollywood comedies, you mean mostly Ernst Lubitsch, Preston Sturges. That,
yes, no, but yeah. Even I think this concrete premise was probably already filmed in some bullshit Hollywood comedy. But I think that there are some twists in my book that... At least I don't know that they exist in some other...
But if I understand correctly your question, sorry, this time will be very short. Maybe you don't know, but I will tell you now. I don't like this guy, Matthias.
Really?
I find him disgusting. I wouldn't like to have a friend like that. Just to make it clear.
It's interesting because he, to me, he's got disgusting traits.
Oh, but what, it's a warm, deep human person.
No.
I don't think he's warm. I don't think he's warm, but he's quite attractive. He's quite sympathetic in a certain kind of honesty in the way that he deals with people.
But he doesn't work anything seriously. He's just a lazy guy. He should be mobilized for forced labor.
That's what photography's like, isn't it?
Sorry?
That's what photographers are like, isn't it?
Okay, why not? Mobilize them, yes. I don't believe in freedom. People should work, my God. Sorry, it's my Stalinism, okay.
No, but as we talked with Nigel, there are some parts in the book that are challenging for the main character in a sense that he has to respond to a critical situation, like when his friends are in despair, or at the end when he has to defend the dignity of a lady. And you can see that at crucial points where it really matters, he is not such a bad guy.
I can see that
point. If the book had been written by a man, I think you would have been accused, if you were a man, you would have been accused of deep sexism, I think, by presenting a character who's got these terrible traits but has some sympathetic aspects, I think. Yeah. There's another question up in that region.
I think it's sort of deeply embedded in our culture tradition that a life in which you don't find your true love is an incomplete life. Do you agree with that proposition? And second of all, if you don't, is that why many people convince themselves they are in love when perhaps they're not?
Sorry, what was the second part of the question? Well, if I don't believe in...
Well, if you the basic proposition is that you need to find your true love to have a complete life in a sort of philosophical sense. But if that doesn't exist, if that's just a false proposition, is that why many people go around thinking they're in love when they're not? Because otherwise they'd have to admit they've got an incomplete life.
Well, that's an interesting and a very good question, I think. I think this assumption is not right. I don't think that people should be in pair in order to have a successful or satisfying life. I think that an individual can have a very, very flourishing life on his own. But it is true that our culture and probably even books like this push us towards this idea and this longing for another person in our life. And that is probably problematic, yes.
You know what would be my position here? I take your question very naively, in a realist way. What do I think? First, I think what I already hinted at, that true authentic love not only doesn't complete your life, it destabilizes it radically. It throws it off the rail and so on. At the same time, I think, and here very classical metaphysician, what my friend Alain Badiou would have called events, like without having a passional commitment, it can be love, it can be
work.
Science, even work, whatever you want, politics and so on. Then, in a way, you remain a human animal. I'm here quite classical metaphysician. Most of us, and not the poor people, the rich even more, they just vegetate. And I think it's, in a way, something very traumatic, but at the same time, deeply satisfying, but not at the level of simple pleasure. If you find some, why not put it in very naive metaphysical terms, some kind of a absolute on which you are transfixed. Like I read, you probably know this more about me, I read somewhere, or a friend of mine drew my attention to it, that the Greek word stasis has a wonderful contrary meaning. It can mean stasis as static, non-changing, but it also means rebellion in the sense of standing up against. And you need, in this sense, a stasis in your life. Maybe it even makes it more unhappy. Because I don't think happiness, for me at least, is not a good category. Happiness is for stupid people. I mean, you
really?
Know... Sorry?
Really?
Listen, I developed in my book, I forgot which one, I write too many of them. I had a wonderful debate in Lithuania years ago when people were really happy. Was there a political regime? And we came unanimously, like in a Stalinist party congress, to the conclusion... Czechoslovakia in the 1970s and 80s, Husak regime. Why? They were living relatively well, materially, not too well, and that's good. If there is meat all the time in the stores, you get used to it, you are not happy. If 2 days per month you don't get meat in the stores, it makes you happy that all other... So that's the first condition. The second condition, you must not be in power. It's too much responsibility. In authentic democracies, you are not happy. There must be someone out there on whom you can put all the blame. Communists in power, no? Third thing, you must have an ideal, like Western Europe, which must not be too far or too close. If it's too far, you don't have a precise idea about it. If it's too close, like for us in ex-Yugoslavia, where borders were completely open the last 20 years, we knew that it's basically the same shit as with us, you know? But so it must be at the right distance to dream about it. Life must be safe. And that was the trick of Husak regime, this decadent normalization after Prague 68, if you didn't mess with politics, you had a certain private life, private niche, satisfaction. You have someone communist in power to blame for and so on. I think people were happy there. It's a very sad confusion. I'm not for that regime, but okay, that's happiness for me. I know you don't agree, that's why.
Well,
I
there
said.
Are obviously different senses of happiness as
yeah,
well.
Yeah,
and subjective
okay,
interpretations
yeah, yeah, yeah,
are
yeah.
not necessarily the only measure. Just picking up on that question, though, about... the kind of self-deceptions in love. It strikes me that Matt, at the beginning of the novel, is suffering from a kind of sentimentality, a kind of unearned emotion, as it were, in his love for Sarah, who he's split up from. Because there's a kind of romanticization of the nature of their relationship. And so that self-deception is actually addressed, I think, in the novel. And there are characters who deceive themselves in various ways. So you definitely do touch on those subjects. But I would agree with the questioner that the area of love is one of those areas where we are so prone to self-deception and so prone to deception as well. It's a particularly vulnerable area. That's part of something we haven't really talked about, how love makes people vulnerable as well. That's seems to be an important aspect of it.
But also one of the deceptions of love is also the most dangerous one, the cynical deception, that you pretend to be a realist. You, like, To give a simple melodramatic example, all of a sudden you become aware of all the faults of your love object. This is not realism. Maybe you are escaping from something and so on. So there can also be deception which appears as its opposite. Now I think I see things clearly and so on and so on. It's, love is a big mess, to put it like this.
One more question.
Hi, thanks. Just touching on the previous question about fulfillment, I just wanted to ask regarding the character in your book and also personally, does your character, so the main protagonist, do the relationships or the one-night stands or the, you know, sexual encounters that he has, do they help with his existential dread? And does marriage in your personal lives, Slavoj in particular, has this helped with your dread existentially?
Sorry,
As I understood it, the question was, look, Matt goes through this whole series of relationships and one-night stands and so on. Does it help appease his existential dread? And Slavoj, in your marriage, does that somehow bring you back away from existential angst?
I cause angst, I hope so. I don't bring peace. The worst thing you can say about me is that I bring peace, or what?
No, but you're a good guy.
Oh, my God.
Sorry.
Do you hate me so much?
Yeah, but as far as the main character goes, I think that the thing is that his frame of mind changes. He starts as this bon vivant Don Juan figure, and then gradually just becomes more sensitive, more maybe even more complex, and then he can enjoy love and relationships in another way than he did at the beginning of his love quest. So there is an evolution of a character, I hope at least, because...
But if I may draw a megalomaniac comparison with my favorite Sam Beckett play, is it non-I or not-I, you know? That
not-I.
Not-I, one monologue. It appears just the same, but it's a very subtle play. Crucial shift happens. It's not just always the same. And I think this is what, unfortunately, maybe many readers will not, but I hope they will, that exactly this is in your novel. It appears just the same on and on, but no, there are subtle changes throughout it. It's not just the same one-night stand story repeated again and again. I mean,
and you can find out yourselves by buying a copy at the back of the room and getting it signed personally. They're priced £10, which is very reasonable for this book, I think.
You repeat this so often, do you get 10% or what? No. Sorry, I must apologize to him. You know how many aggressive, dirty remarks did he have? Probably more, you had more aggressive remarks in last 2 hours than in last 2 years of your life.
Well, I think you're trying to seduce me after having read this book.
Absolutely, but let's keep this between the two of us, don't tell.
Slavoj also has at least one book that he's happy to sign at the back as well, so make sure you buy them before that if you're going to get the signatures.
You, yes.
And I just want to thank the happy couple for
thank
a
you,
wonderful
Nigel.
Session, and thank you very much for your questions and for coming.
Thank you very much.
So you need to run. Could you just... You may be tempted to waylay these guys as they go to the back of the room, but can you just talk to them when they're sitting down at the back rather than as they go past you? Thank you very much.